WSBTRadio.com presents a fan's perspective on Notre Dame sports. This is Dome and Domer.
Welcome back to Dome and Domer, an online conversation about Notre Dame sports from a fan's perspective. I'm Mike Sullivan. Joining me today, Mike Brammer, and from ND Nation, Mike Coffey. And we're going to talk about both football and basketball today, as the Notre Dame men's basketball team starts their season 1-0 after a solid victory over Long Island. But first, let's talk about football. The Irish are reeling, as everybody knows. That's not news to anybody. Let's just talk about, as we head into the Duke game at 1-9, let's just talk a little bit about the big picture. And, you know, this has been debated a lot, but, you know, how did we get here? I think that's what everybody wants to know. You could argue that, it wasn't going to be a great season, rebuilding, et cetera, but, you know, 1-9 is a bit extreme. So, you know, how did we get here? I've got a few thoughts, but let's start this with Mike Coffey. Any explanation on how the season got as bad as it did from your point of view?
Well, I think what's happened is the just everything's kind of snowballed from a bad preparation at the start of the season. I think Charlie really, and if there was a Rick Minner was on the radio in Cincinnati just yesterday answering this very question, and he said that he realized back at that time that the way Charlie would prepare teams with the slower practices and not being physical, so that's how NFL players that were prepared. That's not how college players were prepared. So they went into the Georgia Tech game weeks and weeks behind everybody else. And by the time they got to the training camp mentality, was after Michigan, I believe. Well, by then, you're so far behind everybody else, you'll be lucky if you can pull off anything. And I think that what started with that snowballed into more things going wrong and more things going wrong. And I think what we saw at Air Force maybe is a team that just is just so psychologically beaten down that they're making it possible for themselves to win.
Right. I think that that's a great point. Let's talk about Charlie's approach to the game from what we can guess at. Some of the things, obviously, Rick Minter, somebody on the inside, and that's those are really informative comments. And we're guessing at some other things. But, Bram, in terms of Charlie Weiss's approach, what would you point to as part of the problem?
Well, I mean, it's a combination of things. I don't know that you can really point at one single thing. I mean, there's a bunch of things that have gone wrong this year. But you have to look at, certainly he's only in his third year. I mean, this is his third year, not necessarily of just being a college coach. This is his third year of being a head coach. And there's a world of difference between being an offensive coordinator and a head coach. And granted, I think that a lot of what he did in the pros, he's translated and brought over with him to the college game. But there's a lot of things that don't work in the pros from an approach standpoint.
Well, why did they work the last 2 years?
I mean, I think that you can say that certainly there was some key players at key positions, guys that could make up for a lot, Brady Quinn, Smarja, Stovall. I mean, you're talking about NFL players right there, caliber-wise. And I just think that you had some really – I mean, Brady obviously has made himself into something special and yet to be seen in the NFL. But when you've got a guy at the helm that can call audibles comfortably, that can see the seams, that can pinpoint passes, I mean it
– Yeah, he had the whole package. Yeah, Quinn obviously was a huge difference. And I think Weiss's system with a more veteran, talented group in the upper classes, there wasn't as much of that problem in transition or in translation. But clearly, one of the factors is the talent and leadership depletion of the upper classes. And so when you marry that, the Weiss's NFL approach with a team that's very, very young and inexperienced without much leadership in the upper classes, yeah, you could see that the recipe for disaster was there. I think, talking about the NFL approach, it seems to me that looking at it from a distance, too much emphasis on scheme, on X's and O's, on assignment, and not nearly enough on technique and physical play. I mean, you only have a finite amount of time, and when you spend so much of it on recognition and assignment, that's time you can't spend on being physical and being fundamentally sound.
But you're absolutely right. But I think part of the main part of the issue was when the last couple of years when, as you said, like when he had Quinn and he had Samardzija and guys like that, these are the guys who already had the fundamentals down. For all the faults of the previous coaching regime, they certainly did teach the fundamentals so that that wasn't necessarily what Charlie had to spend his time doing. He could afford to scheme and create the mismatches and focus on those things. When you have a team that is so overwhelmingly inexperienced, plus the fact that your freshmen and sophomores of the last 2 years have spent their time, not necessarily a lot of the time, on the fundamentals, this is where that's finally caught up and bit him. So what Charlie needs to do more than anything is turn around and make the off-season and preseason a focus on fundamentals and strength and attention to those details and not the nuances of when is this play going to go where with these people.
Right. And it will be interesting to see whether or not he can embrace that approach and do those things. I mean, when you've made your reputation as an X and O guy, as a scheme guy, it will be hard to break loose of that, I would think. He is probably a guy that always sees the advantage in scheme and tinkering and X's and O's, and, you know, you just wonder if he'll revert back to that or if he can really commit. Now, the role of the assistant coaches is, I think, really fascinating in this whole dynamic. If any of what we say has validity here in terms of what's really going on, I wonder how the assistant coaches, I mean, a guy like Bill Lewis, for example, you know, he's been around the block, and I'm sure he understands the need for being fundamentally sound and physically tough and so forth. You wonder how he or Jappy Oliver or guys like that, how do they handle a practice schedule or a regime that is not as physical as maybe they think it should be? I wonder if they're, you know, you got to speculate as to whether or not there's any internal division on that coaching staff.
I mean, you can't give all the blame to Weiss. I mean, certainly he doesn't. At a
practice, he sets the agenda, though,
Brent. He sets the agenda. He doesn't sit there and control every single drill that's run. He's not the guy that's offering advice on what's the right way to get down in a four-point stance and so forth. I mean, every now and then he might, but the fact of the matter is a lot of this lies on the assistant position coaches.
Well, I would disagree with you to a certain extent in that if the offensive line could use, say, 40 minutes of individual technique and drill work, and the practice plan calls for them to get 10 minutes of it, what is John Latina supposed to do with that? He's not the guy that's setting the practice plan. I'm, of course, speculating.
Yeah, true.
But
I mean, that's part of it. But my point is that, I mean, these guys take pride in what they do, and when you're a position coach for defensive backs, your aim is to have the best defensive backs in the country. I mean, that's what you do.
Well, let's talk about the defense a little bit, because some of these critiques of the Weiss approach, the, quote, NFL approach, does that apply to the defensive side of things? I mean, I think Bill Minter's reputation was a guy that had a lot of wrinkles and X's and O's, but that's not necessarily Corlin Brown's reputation.
Part of the problem there is you're seeing what a friend of mine called a transitional team in that regard. We're going from a 4-3 to a 3-4. You need different kinds of players in your front seven to play a 3-4. You need a lot more speed at the linebacker position, and you need defensive linemen who can occupy blockers and have defensive linemen that really have to draw the attention of the offensive coordinators for your opponents. I mean, right now, Trevor Law is obviously playing crazy. As someone said last night, on a team with a better record, Trevor Law would be looking at a first-team All-American. Unfortunately, because of we're 1-9, he may not, although I think he'll get some kind of recognition. But Pat Kuntz, as well as he's playing, is really not an outstanding nose tackle.
Brown,
end position
the other side.
Has been just kind of a revolving door.
Non-productive.
Players and
right.
Then you have players on the outside, our outside linebackers, like John Ryan. I mean, I love the guy.
Not making plays.
He's not. And that is going to kill a 3. If you have a glaring weakness on the outside in a 3-4, teams are going to eat you alive.
Well, certainly, I think the explanation on the defensive side of things has more to do with the personnel than anything else. I believe, from my two cents, is the personnel is a huge factor in all this on both sides, as we've talked about at length, just the lack of the senior class, the junior class, they're just not there. And the ripples that creates throughout the whole program, is you can't underestimate that. combine that up with the perhaps the wrong approach, some wrong decisions being made. And then, Mike Coffey, you alluded to the snowball effect. I mean, that's huge. The psychology of sports, as we know, you know, once you're – it's hard to reverse that negative trend once it starts, particularly at a place like Notre Dame where there is so much, the spotlight is so bright. So I think all those things have combined for what we see. But, you know, it's not without hope, certainly, as you look at the recruiting. And Mike Coffey, you have some familiarity with the Omar Hunter situation, the outstanding defensive lineman who was in town over the weekend.
Well, obviously, he if you read all the various recruiting sites and talk to the people who cover recruiting a heck of a lot more closely than I do, Hunter was there with his family. Apparently, the visit apparently went well, and he's just as solid as he's been, which is again is probably the most amazing thing of this entire year. Not only are recruits not bailing, they see themselves as part of the future. The underclassmen, from all reports, have just been devastated by all this, but they still believe, hey, we're going to turn this around and we're going to be part of the solution. So,
look, there is talent there. I mean, there is hope. How can you not see talent when you see Jimmy Clausen, Armando Allen, Robert Hughes, James Aldridge, Duval Kamara, Robbie Paris? There's talent there. I mean, you know, it's the production up front isn't there, and that makes you scratch your head, right? But it's not like you look at this roster and say, oh, my God, there's just nobody on here that can play at the college level. There's a lot of guys that can, which is what is so frustrating about this season. But that's certainly great news to hear that recruits are still committed. And, man, February can't get here soon enough for my money. So,
absolutely.
Okay, let's transition a little bit over to basketball and talk about some really good positive things, and that's Mike Bray's basketball team opening their season with an 82-50 victory over Long Island. Of course, this is the part of the schedule where, you know, a lot of tune-up games getting ready for the Big East, and we can debate on another in more depth, Mike Coffey, we can debate the merits of the schedule. But as the Irish head into the Paradise Jam in the Virgin Islands, it was good to open with an easy, comfortable win. Any thoughts, guys, on what the Irish did last night? Coffee.
Well, I know I think you made an excellent point about the schedule, but some of the things I saw last night transcend who the opponent is. I saw a lot of excellent ball movement. I saw tenacity on defense. I saw good distribution of the time and the points. I mean, because I remember at the end of the game talking to some friends of mine thinking, oh, we probably had at least three or four guys in double figures, and it turned out it was only like two or three, but a bunch of other guys were right there at 8 points. So fact that they were moving the ball well and getting points scored and playing so unselfishly, very, very good to see.
Yeah, and it's a lot like last year's team. I'm glad to see that carryover, at least initially, of great ball movement, commitment to defense, and offense that can come from a lot of different guys. Brammer.
I'll tell you what I like seeing out of that group. And this is a small little thing, but it goes a long way. I mean, Torrey Jackson had to bring a ton of pressure on himself last year, carrying the load after McElhinney exited, and bringing the ball up the court as a freshman all season long. I mean, that does a lot to you, believe it or not. But you got a guy like Hilsland, who is as big as he is and has an unbelievable knack for bringing the ball up the court. I don't know if you saw it, but a couple of times last night, he would, in effect, bring it up the court and allow Torrey to just, you know, take a breather, get over half court, and then get the ball. I think that goes, I mean, think about it. Think who's matching up on Hilsland, knowing that he's the kind of guy. Not only can he take it across half court, he'll go all the way to the bucket every now and then.
I agree, Bram.
It's huge. Yeah.
When you get into the Big East wars, having another guy to handle the ball as Jackson gets, you know, usually the attention of their top guy, right? But as you have another guy besides McElhinney, besides Jackson, that can handle the ball a little bit, relieve some pressure, I think that's a tremendous advantage. But you got to love, you know, Rob Kurz. I mean, how do you not love Rob Kurz? 19 points, 10 boards. Guy does a little bit of everything. He's just so darn tough. Heron Godey kind of chipped in. His normal game was physical. 15 points, 6 boards. But I want to point out a guy who, you know, a lot of people, Irish fans, feel differently about. Luke Zeller chips in 12 points. That's, you know, very close to his career high. But, you know, it's on 5 of 6 shooting. He hit a couple threes. He steps out and can step away from the basket and knock down a perimeter jump shot. That's his game. What do you guys think of what he brings to the table? I don't know that we necessarily need him to be a physical bruiser, which is what everybody really wants out of him. Is there a role for a guy his size to step away from the basket and shoot that jumper? Is that what we need out of him?
If he's hitting 5 out of 6, yeah.
Well, I believe there is. It's going to depend on who's on the floor with him. I mean, if he's out there with, like, Hillis Land and Peoples and McElarney and Jackson, yeah, he's going to need to get down there. And it was reassuring where 2 or 3 times I can think off the top of my head, he did establish himself down in the low post. And I remember at least one scoring opportunity he took advantage of. I also like the fact that he took 1 or 2 mid-range shots. Like, I think it would be great to see a lot of his game in the free throw circle with him playing a high post center. I know when they play against a 2-3, that's what he does, and he's been very effective at it because, as you said,
he passes the ball so well too.
That, and he has that good outside shot. I think Luke Zeller played an excellent game yesterday, and if he can continue contributing like that, that's an X factor for a huge season as opposed to a good one.
Right, and you know, 17 minutes, I think that's a good amount of time for Zeller to contribute. I don't think the days of him starting where we saw last year, he started several games. I don't think we're going to see that with the other guys ahead of him in the rotation, but that's good production off the bench, and you're right, that is the kind of you know, contribution we're going to need. Same with Jonathan Peoples, 15 minutes off the bench. That's excellent. And then
I know one of the key thing that I liked was the minutes distribution. As you said, we had 8 guys play at least 15 minutes. Nobody played more than 32, and that was McElarney. And the next guy after him is Jackson and Kerr's at 28.
But don't get excited, Mike. You know when we get into the Big East, that bench is going to shorten up and those minutes are going to get long.
Yeah, but I don't know.
And that's fine, but what I like is they're not blowing a lot of minutes right now. By the time we get to January, these guys will, like Jackson, McElarney, those guys, will have like maybe 3/4, maybe just over half of the minutes that they had last season. That makes for fresher legs at the end of the year.
Okay, and then last point, this is more like a question to you guys, if you know. The freshman, Carlton Scott and Ty Proffitt, neither saw action. Has it been determined that those guys are going to be held out and with the hopes of a fifth year?
I know there was an article in the Observer last week that pretty much said Scott is going to be redshirted this year. With them not bringing anyone in the fall signing period, I think they're trying to use this to balance the classes out. And Scott's an excellent athlete, but there's got upperclassmen ahead of him who are playing well, and it would be nice if he could put just a couple pounds on and get a little bit more experience. Plus, the article did talk about him, like, paying attention to the academics. You know, sometimes kids make the transition to college, and it's a bit of a shell shock to them when they find out they can't get by with the good grades, and it takes a lot more effort. Sometimes kids make it a little tougher making that transition. I gather Scott's not taking the trip to the Virgin Islands this weekend. He's going to stay in South Bend and really make sure he's got the academic side buckled down before he does anything.
Okay, great. All right, we are out of time. You want one last point, Bramer? Go ahead.
Point.
Hurry up.
Back to football really quick. Just in case anybody didn't catch this, the reason Kamara did not play was an academic violation that was a team violation. It had nothing to do with the university. It was a Charlie Weiss rule, and he stuck to his guns, and that's why he sat. So for all the knocks against Charlie, give him a kudos for that one.
Good. I hadn't heard that one. That's good information, Bramer. We'll let you off the hook for interrupting the flow of the show and jumping back to football. That was a good contribution, Bram. Good job. Okay. We are out of time for this episode of Dome and Domer. If you have any comments, send us an email. And we want to say hello to a good friend of ours, Dr. Steve Dempsey in Saratoga Springs, New York, who caught the show for the first time and was in town over the weekend also. So thanks, Demps. Anyway, send us an email, info@domeanddomer.com, or go to our website and post it right there. Domeanddomer.com is the address for the website. We'll be back again on Thursday with a preview of the big game against Duke, the Irish and the Dukies squaring off. And then we're talking about football, not basketball. Until then, for Mike Coffey and Mike Bramer, I'm Mike Sullivan. We'll see you next time on Dome and Domer.